As you can hear, I've got a little bit of a cold, pneumonia, and flu, and not a reason for the late start. This begins the TechNet number 1534, I guess it is. TechNet's main purpose is education, and guys gather here to help each other understand radio and all the components connected with radio. Person signs into the technical net by giving John, Paul, Dick, and Hal. You give them your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. We put you on the list, and we start off the process of questions and answers. So give me your call letters right now. K2 Raleigh's up here on the tech net.
Joe, Whiskey 2, Bravo, Mike.
Joe, you got cut off. I heard you say Joe, Whiskey 2, Bravo, Mike. Was there anything after that, Joe?
Whiskey 2, Bravo, Mike, Papa, yes, for the question.
Okay, we got you, Joe. Anyone else with a question or a comment, give me your call letters and name right now.
Ed 2, MH, Mark.
Okay, we got you, Mark, and 2, Mike Hotel. Anyone else, give me your call letters and name if you've got a question or a comment for the TechNet. KQRIW listening. One last call. Anyone out there with questions or comments for the TechNet, give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, we probably have more than enough to get started. So Joe, Whiskey 2, Bravo, Mike, Papa. Maybe we're going to have a late night tonight. Participation, in which case you've got a lot of time to ask all your questions. You got it, Joe. W2BMP, K2LIW.
Dick, my question is regarding having a 2-meter antenna vertical and a 40-meter dipole in close proximity. I have 2 ham operators in the house. If my wife is transmitting on 2 meters on the vertical at the same time that I try to transmit on the 40-meter dipole, does that pattern interfere with each other?
There's either 2 or 3 reasons here, Joe, in which the answer will be almost no, with a couple of caveats. First of all, a 2-meter antenna will have very close to zero response from the signal coming from a 40-meter antenna. The two resonant frequencies are so far apart that if you transmitted 1,000 watts on 40 meters and you measured the amount of 40-meter signal coming out of your 2-meter antenna because it's nearby, it might be in the vicinity of a milliwatt. A milliwatt comes out of 40 meters out of your 2-meter antenna when you're transmitting a kilowatt on 40 meters. It might be in that order. And if those are the real numbers, that would represent, I think it's over 60 dB. Let me think now. Kilowatt is plus 60 dBm. No. Yes. That would be a 60 decibel difference. It's 1,000,000 to 1 in power because of the difference in frequency. If you did the reverse experiment, transmit on 2 meters, and measure how much 2-meter signal comes out of the 40-meter antenna, it's going to be a little bit longer, a little bit more than that, maybe 10 or 100 milliwatts, but still a very small fraction of the power, coupled from one to the other. That's factor number one, the differences in resonant frequency. Factor number two that's in your favor, let me drop, is that they're cross-polarized. If you had a purely vertical 40-meter antenna mounted in the middle of your horizontally polarized 40-meter antenna dipole, and you measured the amount of signal coupling between the two, it would be similar to the numbers I've just given you. Because of cross-polarization, even on the exact same frequency, the amount of coupling between the two antennas will be quite a bit smaller than common sense would dictate. Now you combine the two factors. One's vertical, one's horizontal, and there's drastic difference in frequency. The amount of coupling between the two is very small. The amount of interference in pattern between the two is also going to be extremely small. If you measure the pattern of the 2-meter antenna with and without the 40-meter dipole present, slight change in pattern of the 2 meter antenna because of the 40 meter dipole if they were mounted at the exact same altitude, which is not exactly what you're going to do. And in the other direction, the 40 meter dipole will never see the 2 meter antenna because of such a drastic difference. Now, the reason I've given you this information is that when it comes to transmitting pattern and receiving antennas and pattern, they are thoroughly independent antennas, but there's a slight catch. Let me drop it. And that is, a receiver is an extremely sensitive thing. A good receiver on 40 meters, a good receiver on 2 meters, can receive a small fraction of 1 microvolt. And when you're transmitting a kilowatt on 40 meters, you're putting something like 300 volts of RF energy into that antenna. So the receiver is capable of receiving a small fraction of 1 microvolt. We're talking about huge differences in powers here between receiver sensitivity and transmit power. Those numbers I just gave you were well above 90 decibels of difference. In other words, if we express that as a real number, it would be 1 with 9 zeros after it as the ratio of power from one to the other, so to speak, the sensitivity of the receiver versus the transmit power. The reason I'm mentioning this is the following. Depending on how good the RF filter is on the front end of your 40-meter receiver, there's a very slim chance that when full-power 2-meter transmission is taking place, while you're receiving on 40 meters, in other words, your wife is transmitting on 2 meters and you're receiving on 40 meters at the exact same period of time, there could be a slight interference to the receiver. The receiver may hear a couple of phony responses as you tune across the band, and vice versa. So the fact that a transmitter is so potent and nearby, even though the coupling between the two is so small, the receiver might behave a little bit erratically. This is not damaging. The chances of creating damage to the other, you know, operating the receiver on one band while transmitting on the other, the chances of creating the damage are extremely small. Don't worry about it. But you might receive a couple of birdies in the process. If you did, and if you really wanted simultaneous operation during a contest, for instance, then by putting in the right kind of a filter to help the front end of each of the receivers to receive only the band you want would be the quickest solution to the problem. But I think there's a 90% chance even that's not required. Let me give you another example along these lines. You've now got a vertically polarized 2-meter antenna, and your 40-meter dipole most likely is horizontally polarized. Although it is possible for a guy with a good, strong, high tower to set up a 40-meter vertical dipole, but that's a little bit more rare. That would be a high-performance antenna, by the way, if he did do it. If you now go the next step of the extreme, say, for instance, you're a operator on 6 meters and your wife's an operator on 2 meters, and you got a 6-meter Yagi and a 2-meter Yagi both mounted to the exact same mast, and one antenna might be 4 feet above the other, and now they're co-polarized, they're both horizontally polarized, and they're a little bit closer in frequencies, and would the patterns interfere with each other on those two Yagis on the same mast a few feet apart? The answer is no. There'd be almost no measurable difference in pattern because of the huge differences in frequencies. One antenna does not see the other. However, in that particular case, if you transmit at a high power on 6 meters at the same time you're trying to receive on 2 meters, the amount of cross-coupling and birdies in the receiver response would be a little bit stronger. But again, putting in the right kind of filter will make that problem go away. So you've got a very logical-sounding question here, Joe, and the chances of you being in trouble with those dual bands of operation is very close to zero. Have at it. Go do it. And if you see any kind of undesirable response, come back and tell us about it. Whiskey 2, Bravo Mike Papa, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you very much for that response, and I hate it when she's right, so we'll see how it goes. Thanks, Ben.
Okay, you said some magic words there, Joe. Give us a few more words on that. You hate it when she's right. In other words, I think what's going on here is your wife has listened to either the TechNet or read some articles and whatever, and found out that the interference of one band versus the other is extremely minor. difficult to measure, probably zero most of the time. Your wife probably has that opinion, and you being a little bit more conservative said there could be some interaction. Is that approximately what happened to Joe? W2BMB, KQLIW.
Yeah, I happen to be a QRP type of guy, so I'm on very low power. I'm using a KX3, Electrocraft KX3, and she's constantly on 2 meters, and I'm not getting the performance that I expect on my 40-meter dipole, so I figured perhaps it's because she put up this little vertical 2-meter antenna that may be hindering my performance, but obviously, that's not the case. I'll have to look elsewhere for the problem.
Yeah, let me give you one further example of this. One of the equations that's the bedrock of the antenna science is gain of an antenna equals a fixed number, 4 pi, times A over lambda squared. Okay, 4 pi is something like 12.6. So gain equals 4 pi, A over lambda squared. Lambda is the wavelength squared. You're going to divide that into the effective area of the antenna. You plug in the numbers, you reverse the equation, you solve for area instead of gain. Area is gain lambda squared over 4 pi. You plug in the numbers for 40 meters, and I think you're going to find out that a 40-meter antenna has more than 2,000 square meters of effective area. Yes, 2,000 square meters. If your eye operated at 40 meters and you looked at that 40-meter antenna, you would see a huge oval in space where the oval is about 80 feet wide and probably about 40 feet high. A huge oval in space would look black to you, to your 40-meter eyes if they operated there. And all of the horizontally polarized 40-meter signal arriving in the vicinity of your dipole would be sucked up by that 2,000 square meter effective area of that antenna. All of that energy would end up onto the wire of the antenna, go down the feed line, and affect the signal strength meter on your receiver. The 2-meter antenna, your eye tells you that the 2-meter antenna at best is a couple of square feet of area to it, radio area. So if at worst it was in direct line, in other words, if the 2-meter antenna was at the exact same altitude, 5 feet in front of a 40-meter dipole, directly in line with the guy you want to talk to in Europe, and therefore you assume that your 2-meter antenna is casting a shadow.
Repeater, time out.
I'm waiting for the eastern repeater to come back. Oh, there it is. Therefore, because they're directly in line, you would assume the 2-meter antenna at the exact same altitude, a few feet in front of a 40-meter dipole, directly in line with Europe, is casting a shadow and therefore sucking up some of the signal. Even if at worst it was doing that, and it can't do it because the frequencies are wrong. The real area of that 2-meter antenna on 40 meters is a few square inches, its physical area. Only when an antenna hits resonance does this great big oval of area come about. So even if I took the worst case of the full area of your 2-meter dipole, a 2-meter vertical antenna, and cast it onto that great big oval I just described, 2,000 square meters on 40 meters, as you can tell, it would be 0.1% of change in effective area. Not even the width of your signal strength meter would represent that change in signal strength. So there's multiple ways you can look at this: cross-polarization, non-resonance on the other frequency, effective capture areas, no matter how you look at it. If the reverse situation, if your wife on 2 meters, let me drop. If your wife in operating the 2-meter antenna was going to say that, hey, this wire antenna of yours that's 67 feet long at the same altitude as my 2-meter antenna, that's a lot of wire in front of my 2-meter antenna, so to speak, if they were at the same altitude. And would she complain that the 2-meter response is now less because of the 40-meter antenna? There, your eye sees, you know, the reverse of the situation, the great big antenna in 40 meters casting a shadow on a 2-meter antenna. Common sense would lead you to believe that that could be a problem. It would not be a problem. Because of cross-polarization, they don't see each other. Because of huge differences in resonant frequency, they don't see are at different altitudes, they're not going to see each other. So in either direction, if you try to measure the detriment of the presence of one antenna on the performance of the other antenna, you wouldn't be able to do it, Joe. So, now, whether or not the 40-meter band, let me drop this. Whether or not the 40-meter band has got a good ionospheric condition during the times that you want to operate, depending on whether or not your 40-meter antenna is a good altitude above the ground, so you're getting the right vertical takeoff angle because of ground reflection, whether or not your antenna is a Nevis antenna or high enough altitude to give you some good DX, whether or not your property is high in altitude compared to the surrounding terrain, and are there a lot of buildings around, is there a lot of QR Mary noise, QR Nancy noise, a local parking lot with a whole lot of fluorescent lighting that's giving you excess noise on 40 meters and raising your noise threshold. There's a zillion things that can create less than full desirable performance on your 40-meter dipole. And step by step, you can investigate each one of those if you would like to and find out, are there people with a similar setup as your 40-meter setup who are doing a lot better than you at the same hour of the day? You can do comparisons along those lines. So there's a number of things here to investigate. But of all of those things, let me drop this. In my opinion, the one that's going to be on the bottom of the list is the presence of a 2-meter antenna. You're allowed to ask some more questions on this extra information I just gave you, Joe. Whiskey 2, Bravo Mike, Papa, C2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, thank you very much. You gave me the answer that I was looking for, and it becomes obvious to me now that once you do the math and think it through, that you're right. We have a very minimal effect. So thank you very much for your response, W2BMP.
As you and your wife do further investigation on your two bands of favorite interest, and as you find out more about what's making it work well and what's not making it work as well and so on, if you find out anything along those lines, Joe, your situation is not unique. Please come back and tell us what you find. We're giving you homework, a very poorly defined homework there, Joe. Okay, Mark is next, November 2, Mike Hotel. What would you like to talk about tonight, Mark? K2RIW, the TechNet.
Okay, to K2RIW and the TechNet, this is N2MH. We're located in New Jersey, West Orange, and we have a couple of comments for the net. First of all, to the gentleman who just asked a question about his QRP station and the 2-meter station, I think to answer the question if you're being affected or not, you know, one of the very first answers you can get is, are you having any trouble when she's transmitting, and does that trouble go away when she's not transmitting? If the answer is no, well then, you're pretty much on your way to seeing that there's no effects. So, end of the first comment. Okay, the second comment has to do with, is actually directed at Joe, WA2RYY. Last week, the week before, he was asking about, he was talking about a multi-pan dipole he wanted to erect, using individual wires rather than a trap dipole and a trap arrangement. Some time ago, there was a commercial antenna out on the market, and we're talking like the 70s and 80s type of time frame, called the Morgain antenna, M-O-R-G-A-I-N. And that was an antenna that did pretty much what Joe was looking to do. I just hope he's on here. I didn't hear him check in. So if he does check in, we're going to have to relay this to him later on, I suppose. But this was a Morgain antenna, M-O-R-G-A-I-N. Search the net, and you'll find some information about it. Back to the net, N2MH.
Give us a description of what the Morgain antenna looked like, Mark. Describe the Morgain antenna. And is there more than one version that operates on 2, 3, 4, and 5 of the high-frequency bands? I'm not familiar. familiar with more gain. I should be. Over to you, Mark.
Okay, I'm letting the repeater drop so that it resets all kinds of timers all over the place and not just the Waymark timers. Anyhow, the more gain antenna, I remember my friend had one. It was a 5-band array, and it basically had, I think, 5 wires on it. Each wire was a dipole for its own band. Back in those days, it was 80, 40, 20, 15, and 10, 5 bands. And they were, oh, maybe an inch apart, and they were held in place with some sort of insulator that was drilled to let the wire pass through. And that's kind of how I kind of remember it. When I looked up the net, they actually started out with a 2-band version, 80 and 40, which was basically just 2 wires. Then I think as they went up in capacity and coverage, they went to this 5-wire array. Well, if I'm looking at the drawings correctly, you know, the pictures that are not so good, they may have had some wires in there that actually folded back upon themselves and were able to resonate that way. So it's a fairly involved antenna. And my own timer there. A friend of mine, WB2SZZ at the time, had one, and he kind of liked it. Back to that.
By your description, it does sound like a fan dipole. And one of the things that we say rather frequently on the TechNet, because it's not well said in the antenna books, it's not well taught in the classes, that if you want to build a good antenna on any frequency, resonate first, then it will radiate. Resonance of the antenna is extremely important. As such, your 80 or 40 meter dipole at the exact same altitude as the Con Ed wiring across the street from you, or the Long Island Lighting Company wiring, you know what I mean, the New Jersey Power and Light wiring, even though that wiring is larger in diameter at the exact same altitude, directly in line with the guy you want to talk to in London, we'll say, you would assume that wiring is going to cast a big shadow on you. And the answer is it doesn't. Let me drop. Because with rare exception, that wiring is not resonant on each one of the frequencies you want to use. Therefore, that wire has a couple of square feet of physical area casting a shadow onto your 80 or 40 meter dipole, which has many thousands of square meters of radio area because of its resonance phenomena. Resonance is really the magic. So in the case of a fan dipole, when that signal comes down the transmission line and hits that center insulator, one of those antennas will be resonant at that frequency. You'll be transmitting a 40-meter signal. The 40-meter dipole will be resonant, presenting a 73 ohm impedance, and 99% of the power will flow from your transmission line into the 40-meter dipole. The 80-meter dipole is sitting right there. Common sense would lead you to believe that, hey, that's on the second harmonic. Second harmonic of 80 meters is 40 meters. So therefore, there should be some resonance on 80 meters, on the 80-meter dipole, because of the 40-meter signal. Not at all. Because each half of the 80-meter dipole is now a 40-meter dipole being fed at the tip, not at the center, where the impedance is thousands of ohms, of more primarily capacitive reactance, but thousands of ohms. Let me drop. Because the 80-meter dipole has an impedance of thousands of ohms and primarily reactive, and the 40-meter dipole has got 73 ohms, you now can see electronically why the signal from the transmission line will flow into the right dipole, and that dipole will behave as if the other dipoles are not even there. So the magic of a fan dipole, I don't care if it's a 2-band, 5-band, 7-band, or whatever fan dipole, is that it becomes an electronic automatic switch because of the resonance phenomenon. It's as if there was a bandpass filter between the transmission line and the 40-meter dipole, only allowing 40-meter signals to go there, and correspondingly there appears to be an 80-meter bandpass filter the 80-meter dipole. That those two bandpass filters, even though your eye doesn't see it and the schematic on the paper doesn't see it, they really are there. Again, it's the magic of resonance. So, in theory, only one of those dipoles will really be the right kind of resonance at each one of these frequencies, and the signal will flow down the right one. So, fan dipoles are an extremely high-performance antenna. Each one of the dipoles behaves 98% like all the other dipoles that are there. The signal always flows down the right one, and you can even build a more elaborate versions of those if you want to, where some of those dipoles are at right angles to the others. In other words, your 80-meter dipole on your fan dipole system might be set up east-west, and your 40-meter dipole on this fan dipole system may be set up north-south. And as funny as that will look top view, electronically, it's a beautiful antenna. And again, those individual frequencies don't interfere with each other. The physical layout doesn't interfere with each other. And so you can get away with murder on this one. Let me drop it. And yet you can now even go the next step. The 80-meter dipole, in theory, should be around 132 feet long, tip to tip. And maybe the diagonal dimension of your property is only 98 feet. What do you do? Nothing stopping you from setting up a fan dipole where the 80-meter portion of the fan dipole has a loading coil near the base, top hat capacitors near the tip, or the wire of the 40-meter dipole goes out as far as your property goes out and then drops down vertically from there, or even folds back a little bit. In other words, as long as the 80-meter dipole with your new physical layout, loading coils, zigzag, dropping down the tips, top hat capacitors at the end, even a loading inductor or a resonator along the length of the 80-meter dipole. There's all kinds of ways that you can force a 80-meter dipole to be resonant at 80 meters and yet be physically shorter than the normal 132 feet. That antenna will behave like a charm. It'll have no sacrifice in gain, no sacrifice in effective capture area. That's the hard one to believe. Let me drop. When you take that 80-meter dipole and you shrink it down as much as you want in physical length by using all of those tricks, zigzag, loading coils, helical winding, top hat capacitors, drop down at the ends, and all of these techniques, you can make the antenna physically shorter. As long as it hits resonance, and you've done a reasonably good job of impedance matching to it, you will get the exact same gain, the exact same effective capture area. The infinitesimal dipole, the dipole that is a very small fraction of its normal length, but you have forced it into resonance with low loss materials, will never lose more than 0.5 dB in gain compared to a full out half wave dipole. Of course that sounds crazy. Let me drop. Once again, that's the magic of resonance. All of that effective capture area, because of resonance, comes back. There is a disadvantage. As you start shrinking the antenna down in physical size, it will become higher in Q. It will become more narrow band at the points where it hits 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, for instance. But you won't lose gain, you won't lose effective capture area. And the so-called half dB of gain that you lose is not a gain due to power loss, I squared R loss. The pattern of an infinitesimal dipole, the figure eight pattern becomes a little bit broader in the figure eight. That's where the half dB of gain and the bird's eye direction goes down half a dB. It's not a real gain loss. It's a slight shift in pattern, very slight shift. So there's zillions of ways that you can force multiple band antennas together as a fan dipole and do all kinds of physical variations to match your particular layout of trees and towers and supports on the house and the dimensions of the land and so on. And if you have the faith to do it, except for the more narrowness of bandwidth, they all will work. See if you have any further comments on the above, Mark. N2 Mike Hotel, KQRIW in the TechNet. And you were giving us information about Joe's antenna, and so maybe you've got another question of your own. And if you do, there is the time for it. N2MH, K2RIW.
K2RIW in the TechNet, this is N2MH. Well, actually, no, I don't have another question. I just wanted to put this out for Joe's sake. If he wanted to look it up on the net, maybe he could get some ideas out of how to do what he wants to do. Comment on your last go-around. I think you hit the nail on the head when you said the antennas, the two elements have to be at right angles to each other. It's been my experience that when the elements are in line, then that whole theory kind of falls apart and it becomes extremely difficult to tune that kind of antenna. I understand what you're saying about the impedances of an end-fed halfway versus the impedance of a mid-fed antenna. But the two antennas are very tightly coupled when they're in line like that. And there's something else going on that doesn't quite meet the eye. Anyhow, that's all I wanted to do, Dick. Why don't you go on with somebody else who may have a question or a comment or whatever. Take care in 73. K2RIW, N2MH.
Yeah, let me correct you on that one, Joe. You heard my words and you read a logical conclusion into them. And that's not what I was saying. I'm just giving examples of drastic physical variations that you can build with a fan dipole if you desire. And I gave the example of the 80-meter dipole being east-west and the 40-meter dipole being north-south. I'm saying you could make that huge physical change and the electrical performance of the antenna, you wouldn't know the difference. An ordinary fan dipole, all of the dipoles could be all laying north-south, if that's what you wanted to do, all parallel to each other, with an angular separation in the center of, let me pick a number, 10 degrees. That's a typical way a guy sets up a fan dipole. The amount of cross-coupling between those dipoles, even though they're parallel to each other, is extremely small, the amount of cross-coupling, because they have completely separate resonant frequencies. They do not cross-couple, even though they're parallel. The most extreme example is the guys who make a fan dipole by using as raw material the ribbon cable that's used for a antenna rotator, where you have 4, 5, 6, 8 individual wires all laying parallel to each other over 1/16 of an inch apart in that ribbon cable. And by cutting those individual wires to the right length, you can make a fan dipole out of that structure. That's the most extreme case, where the separation now is so tight, yes, you will get some cross-coupling. The 80-meter dipole, in that case, you simply tune it, no problem. The 40-meter dipole, which is a 1/16 inch away from the 80-meter dipole, will definitely send some capacitive coupling. Therefore, the physical length of the 40-meter dipole will have to be cut down probably a number of feet.
Repeater, timeout.
It will have to be cut down a number of feet before it will hit resonance, the 40-meter dipole, because of extremely close coupling. That's the most extreme case. But even in that extreme case, once you properly hit the right tuning by starting at the lower frequency and work your way up, that can be a fully effective antenna, with one slight exception. You're now experiencing very high voltages on the tips of those wires. A good dipole has got a Q of 10 to 1. That merely means the voltage of the tip is 10 times higher than the voltage you're applying in the center from the transmission line. So therefore, you've got rather high voltages across very small lengths of rubber, of the ribbon cable. And that rubber is not known to be an extremely high efficiency dielectric material at these frequencies. So you'll get a little extra loss. But that's the most extreme case. The average way a guy builds a fan dipole, each of the individual dipoles tune independently like all of the other dipoles are not there. So even parallel is not bad. Nowhere near as much cross-coupling as common sense would indicate. Try it, you'll like it. Over to you for a comment on that, Mark. N2 Mike Hotel, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW in the TechNet, N2MH. Yes, exactly. And separation of the ends is what is key here, and that wasn't quite so obvious in either of our discussions. So yes, I'm glad to see that came out. The Bourgain, however, was in line and parallel several inches away. So I don't know how he did it. Whenever I tried to do it, I always had a hard time and gave up because I got impatient about the whole thing. One of the bands simply didn't tune right, and I just gave up. That was many moons ago. Maybe I'll have to do it again with retirement coming up. H.I. K2RIW and 2MH.
What about the boundary of what you call side of antennas?
So even though you ran into some problem with that one, Mark, and maybe the 10-meter didn't tune as well as you'd like, or the 15-meter didn't tune as well as you'd like, and you didn't hit resonance when you dropped it, I recommend you not give up on that antenna. It's got a lot of performance capability. And a fan dipole, each of those individual dipoles will have very close to the same bandwidth as if each individual dipole was all by itself. Only in the extreme case of the ribbon cable version will the higher frequency bands, in other words, if you build an 80, 40, 20, 10 out of ribbon cable, you'll see no difference on the 80. But the 40, 20, 15, and 10 will have a little bit narrower bandwidth because of the close capacitive coupling to the adjacent larger elements, and therefore they have to be physically shortened in order to hit resonance. They will experience a little bit sharper bandwidth. Very similar to any kind of dipole. Any dipole that you make physically shorter than a half wave, no matter how you do it. Loading coils, zigzag, top hat capacitors, dropping down the ends, spiral winding, no matter what you do it, to lower the amount of physical real estate tip to tip of the antenna. All of those techniques will give you re-resonance at the shorter length, but slightly higher Q, slightly more narrow bandwidth. That's the trade-off. The lowest Q antenna in the world is the one that's got the full length and very fat resonator, very fat radiator. Well, in the case of 80 meters, to make a fat radiator, like an eighth of a wavelength in diameter, let me think now, an eighth of a wavelength in diameter, or something like 32 feet, very few of us, very few of us are going to build each half of an 80-meter dipole out of a piece of tubing 32 feet in diameter. Now, by way of the caging technique of multiple wires with a spider in between, you can electronically achieve that. If you look at any of the photographs of the ARRL antenna system at Newington, Connecticut, you will see an 80-meter dipole that's built in the cage dipole manner. In other words, they've got this spreader structure to the left and to the right at the center insulator, which really, that dipole consists of four wires instead of one wire, which makes it electronically larger in diameter and gives them more bandwidth. I took that concept to a ridiculous extreme when it comes to the antennas that I was building at 915 megacycles, where I was building them out of copper tape, taped down onto a piece of clear plastic, and the individual elements of a three-element Yagi were being built three-quarters of an inch wide on a frequency where the wavelength is, well, let me think now. I think it's something like 9 inches. Is it 90 centimeters? Here we go. 35 centimeters, in that order. All of a sudden, I've forgotten that each individual half dipole is around 4.5 inches long. And if you got a 4.5 inch long half-wave dipole, the driven element, for instance, let me drop it. And the element is made out of copper tape that's 3/4 of an inch wide. I guess that's an 8-to-1 ratio of width to length. And you build the director, the driven element, and the reflector in that manner. And if you properly tune it, a good network analyzer, where you're simultaneously looking at gain and standing wave ratio. One is a yellow curve on the screen, which represents gain, and the blue curve that represents a way around. That blue curve was gain, and the yellow curve was standing wave ratio. So I tuned it so that the blue curve went as high as possible across the frequency range. That was gain. and the yellow curve was as low as possible on the screen. That was the standing wave ratio. And when you properly do that, you can get a three-element Yagi on 915 megacycles that works between 902 and 928 megahertz. That's a 3% bandwidth. It's got more than 6 dB of gain over ISO over that whole region. And the standing wave ratio is considerably lower than 1.1 to 1 across the whole frequency region. That antenna is a completely separate patent. That patent was issued somewhere around 2005. And so Mr. Hindusugi Yagi invented the Yagi antenna somewhere around 1927. Let me drop. And a crazy guy named K2RIW re-patented the Yagi antenna with a drastic variation with much higher performance in roughly 2005. And that patent was issued. That antenna is being manufactured. It sits on the front end of a very well-respected radio frequency identification interrogator or reader, if you know what I mean. That antenna sits out in front of this handheld reader. And the reason why you have to have an extremely low standing wave ratio on a RFID reader is because it really is a kind of a CW radar system. It is thoroughly simultaneously transmitting and receiving on the exact same frequency at each instant of time. The signal you transmit goes over to the RFID tag, which is really a half-wave dipole antenna with a chunk of electronics sitting in the center and no battery on board the tag. A tag rectifies the energy you put into that dipole that charges a capacitor. The capacitor becomes a temporary battery that runs the integrated circuit chip. The integrated circuit chip modulates the impedance on the antenna with a particular digital pattern. That digital pattern transmits 96 bits of information back to your reader in a thoroughly passive manner. And it can do that over a distance of 24 feet. There's a real chunk of magic there. But that reader is transmitting at one instant of time, we'll say 915.00 megahertz. It's listening to the echo off the tag. That's a digital modulated signal at 915.00 megahertz. The antenna that sits on the front end of that reader better have an extremely low standing wave ratio, because if it doesn't, the reflected signal from your own antenna will jam your own receiver. If you can make the reflection coefficient of the antenna low enough, that's a fancy way of saying very low standing wave ratio, then the only echo you hear is off the tag 24 feet away, and you read that signal. Ain't that crazy? So as you can see, the magic of resonance and the magic of very large bandwidth, very large width of resonators within your antenna can give you all of that benefit. And so that particular crazy combination, and a little bit more to the patent, what made it unique, but still, who would ever think that 25 years later, 75 years later, somebody could reinvent and repatent the Yagi antenna, which under normal circumstances you would say, hey, that's already something that's already been invented. You can't reinvent it. Well, if you make a big enough variation with a high enough amount of performance improvement, the patent office will consider that a thoroughly set
repeater timeout.
Under those conditions, the patent office will consider that as a thoroughly separate invention and issue another patent on the subject. I know that I'm off to one side of what you're asking, Mac, but maybe you've got some further questions or comments on all of the above. Glad you brought this information to us. November 2, Mike Hotel, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW on the TechNet. Well, yeah, you just touched on a couple things that I have to comment on. Number one, when you make the antenna short, you make it thick, and it will still resonate. I have experienced that, and I actually have documented on my website. I took a little slightly different go to my website, www.ntubemhnet. You can dig down there and find it. I did it for several other bands, and I think 20 meters turned out to be about 8 or 9 inches high. And from the Mobile, I was able to work Alaska with that antenna on 20, so they do work. The performance is not as good, but like you say, you take a hit, and that's that. And regarding your 900 meg work, well, believe it or not, you've just described EasyPass. EasyPass works the same way. They are on 900. In fact, they are. They do have a license. They're running 1 watt CW. And for some reason, their tags are powered. They do have a battery in it. So beware, if you're going through EasyPass sometime and all of a sudden it doesn't seem to be registering anymore, well, your battery probably crapped out and you need to replace the tag. K2RIW, N2MH.
Now, the EasyPass tag has a battery to increase its receiver sensitivity, the uplink sensitivity. A fairly passive tag only receives power from rectifying the RF energy that comes to the tag on the forward link from the interrogator, from the receiver, from the reader. And so with state-of-the-art tags, you can barely get 24 feet out of that with what I would call 50% reliability. Maybe you get 90% reliability at 20 feet instead of 24 feet, and so on. In the case of EasyPass, you'd like to be able to read the tag on the car when the tag is defined. A very thick chunk of glass on the windshield. The chunk of glass may be partially silvered. The tag itself may be sitting alongside of the metal rim of the windshield. Let me drop. And you'd like to be able to read that tag at, say, 100 feet. When the car is whizzing through the toll gate at 40 miles an hour, you'd like to start reading the tag when the car is 100 feet away. So that is a semi-passive RFID tag. It has a battery powering the receiver. Now the receiver is active all the time, so to speak. It doesn't need RF energy to be rectified. And now all it's got to do is modulate the antenna impedance so that the reader that's at the toll gate can read your information from, say, 100 feet away. One of the other things you said, and you put words in my mouth, Mark, and that is making the antenna fat makes it shorter. It is true, but it's only a small percentage. As I made an antenna go from a very skinny piece of wire to a very fat piece of sheet metal, the length probably is going to come down by 15 or 20%. And if you want to shrink it further by making it fatter, that's not the way to do it. If you really want to shrink an antenna by 2 to 1, 4 to 1 ratio, you've got to do something else. Loading coils, zigzag, spiral winding, top hat capacitors, dropping down the end, and so on. So fatness does lower the length, but only by relatively small percentages compared to the usual need. I made those antennas fat. Let me drop.
Common.
I made those antennas fat in order to lower their Q. The main thing that happens when you make a radiator fat is the bandwidth goes up real fast. The tip-to-tip length comes down very slowly, but the bandwidth goes up very fast. You make the antenna fat enough, and a dipole that normally has only a couple of percent of bandwidth before it hits 2 to 1 standing wave ratio can now be many times broader. And that's the main thing I was looking for. The antenna I needed for that RFID reader had to cover the full 3% from 902 to 928 megahertz. It had to have extremely low standing wave ratio, 1.1 to 1 maximum, 1.05 desired across that whole 26 megahertz of bandwidth. And without going to very wide techniques, that is, what's the word for it? Not achievable with normal dipole three-element Yagi-like structures. Let me drop. But with careful tuning techniques of very wide radiators, you can get that bandwidth. And by the way, I'm talking about a 1.1 standing wave ratio bandwidth, where the usual person describes bandwidth is where the antenna hits 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, not 1.1. And the 2-to-1 standing wave ratio of that antenna probably was not 26 megs wide, probably was 50 megahertz wide. I did make a similar structure once where the antenna was 150 megahertz wide at 915 megahertz, and the standing wave ratio across that whole region was better than 1.1 by very wide element techniques. Let me drop. Now, what's interesting to know about these wide element techniques is, at least as of 2010, the best available computer modeling programs of that era could not model those antennas. The reason why I say that's important is
UAB.
I know there are two people out there who want to make a comment, and Barry is one of them. I'll get to both of you guys. Hang in there. Because the majority, if not every single one, of the antenna vendors in the United States brag about the fact that we are modern. We use computer-aided design. We use computer modeling techniques. Every antenna we build, we model it first, and then we build it. They brag about that. As such, that whole class of antennas that I worked on for the previous 10 years, of which 30 patents have been applied for, and 26 of those patents have been issued, that whole class of antennas will never be discovered by those people using computer modeling programs, because the computer modeling programs cannot tolerate elements that are that large in diameter. Therefore, they will never find it. Ain't that crazy? First was the person who said comment. Who was that? Give us your call letters, your name, and your comment. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, maybe that person got called away. Barry, N2MB, go right ahead.
Okay, yeah, I was thinking while you were talking, if those antennas were a half wave, whatever your antenna was, if you cut a V-shaped notch at both ends of that wide piece of tape, wouldn't that make it broadbanded?
The most broadband you're going to get, Barry, is to use the most copper you've got. You fill up the area with copper, and the antenna becomes more and more broadband. You start drilling holes, notches, slots, and other things in that copper. You could, if you want to, emphasize or de-emphasize certain frequencies, but your overall flat standing wave ratio bandwidth in general will come down. Now, one of the examples that you and I have worked with in the early days of television reception, a very popular antenna way back in the 1950-1960 time frame, was the so-called double conical television aerial. It really was a dipole-like structure with a reflector, where the dipole-like structure was really built out of a skeleton of wire that really was a triangle on the right side and a triangle of wire on the left side. That was the skeleton conical radius, so to speak. What would they call it? There's another name. Butterfly. A butterfly-like structure. And there was the UHF equivalent antenna. Let me drop. Which was made out of right and left triangles of a butterfly-like structure. And yes, some of those did have a V-notch cut into the tips of the UHF antenna. Bear in mind now that the UHF antenna was no ordinary antenna. It was trying to cover 470 to 890 megacycles, channel 14 to channel 83, and that was a very tall order. So they tried all kinds of fancy techniques, but in general, for the kinds of bandwidth you and I desire, I think you may not come out ahead by drilling a notch. But tell me what makes you think so, Barry. N2 Moon Bounce, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Those were bow ties, Dick.
That's the word I'm looking for, bow tie. Barry, you got it.
Okay. No, I was thinking, for instance, the first you would start with, if you want to cover a range of frequencies, you'd have like multi-dipoles, very close in frequency. But you could exaggerate that by just having one wide strip that was cut on a slant.
You know, and I was thinking that would be the same thing, except it would be more linear. You know, you wouldn't have any spaces between it, and that should be broadband.
And you were cutting that slant on the right side and left side, a notch, so to speak, in order to make it follow the outside dimensions of a fan dipole. However, if you really filled it up and didn't cut the notch, you literally made a bow tie, right side and left side. You will come out with flatter, larger bandwidth. Opposite of common sense. But I'm guessing what happens, Barry, is that when there's a very wide piece of copper, somewhat like a bow tie, the RF energy can decide to go straight down the center if it wants to. It can go down the outer perimeter if it wants to. And because it's got a wide piece of copper to operate on, that radio signal can go down there zigzagging across that piece of copper if it wants to. And what that radio signal does, in all cases, it takes all possible paths. To convince yourself it's doing that in copper, I will admit, is difficult. But let me show you the inverse of that. The bow tie of the copper antenna is a conductor, a great big wide bow tie-shaped conductor in space. Let me drop. The antenna that you and I are transmitting and receiving on is the exact opposite. It's a thin piece of copper in space, and there's nothing but empty space in between the two. You and I have talked about it enough so that we've convinced each other that multipath takes place. That signal that's coming from my antenna in Huntington, going to your antenna in Far Rocky Way, as you call it, you'd like to believe the signal takes the direct path. Yes, it does. But it takes more than a million other paths simultaneously. You can't stop it from doing that. The signal coming out of my antenna goes into every possible direction in three-dimensional space. And every time that signal strikes any other object, ground, water tower, building, tree, whatever structure you can think of, and even if that structure is what you believe is dielectric, an insulating structure, like a completely dry evergreen tree. Let me drop. Yes, that evergreen tree is a non-conductor. Put your ohm meter against it, and you'll think it is multiple megohms across any one of those branches, any one of those needles or whatever. However, the tree has got the wood of the tree and the needles and whatever has a dielectric constant of 3, 4, or 5, depending on how much water is in it. The signal, whenever it hits anything except clear air or a vacuum, 377 ohms per square, whenever it's 377 ohms impedance, when it hits anything else, there will be a reflection. A thoroughly dry 2x4 held in front of your antenna is a reflecting object, even though it's thoroughly insulating, because it's got a dielectric constant of that wood of 3 or 4. It's a different material. Therefore, there will be a reflection. So, there's a million objects between you and I that are reflecting that signal. And the signal you get right now is a function of every one of those millions of paths being calculated as a voltage with a particular delay because of the path it has taken, which gives it a certain phase shift. So it's 1 million voltages going to your receiving antenna with 1 million individual phase angles. Your antenna adds up all those voltages in a vector manner. That means it's adding the voltage magnitude with the phase angle. Comes up with a composite voltage that goes down your transmission line and operates your receiver. So in free space, multipath is taking place. You cannot stop it. By the same token, multipath is taking place inside of a copper of your and my wide butterfly antenna. It chooses every possible path back and forth. As such, some of those paths will resonate at your and my crazy frequency right now, which is not the length that you and I cut the dipole, the butterfly dipole for, the bow tie bite type
repeater. Time out.